Imagine a company, a name that's been around for an incredible 150 years. Valvoline, practically synonymous with motor oil. You know, the lifeblood of our cars for generations.
A real legacy brand.
Totally. Now, picture that same company making a radical, almost, well, unthinkable pivot, shedding its deep manufacturing roots to focus on something entirely different. That's a fascinating story we're diving into today.
It really is a remarkable strategic shift, isn't it? A real case study in corporate reinvention, you could say. We're going to take a deep dive into Valvoline Inc., ticker VVV, and really zero in on this dramatic transformation into what they call a pure-play automotive service retailer.
Right.
Our mission, like always, is to pull out the most important insights from the sources you've given us, help you understand the company's strengths, the significant challenges it's facing, and crucially, where its future might be headed in this, well, rapidly changing auto world.
And here's where it gets really interesting, maybe even a bit counterintuitive. We need to unpack the huge gamble Valvoline's taking. I mean, why is a company built on oil now betting its whole future on not just selling oil, but on servicing your car?
It's a massive strategic bet.
And the biggest question mark, the elephant in the garage, maybe. How does Valvoline plan to navigate the massive accelerating shift towards electric vehicles? EVs, which, as you know, don't even use engine oil.
Yeah, that's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
It's a strategic high wire act for sure. And we're here to break down every single part of it for you.
Okay, let's get into it.
All right, so let's unpack this monumental transformation. For decades, like most of its history, Valvoline was kind of a hybrid company.
Yeah, two different businesses under one roof, essentially.
Exactly. On one side, they had their global products business. That was manufacturing, distributing lubricants, chemicals, all that stuff worldwide.
The traditional Valvoline most people think of.
Right.
Making the oil.
Right. And then on the other side, a completely separate thing, their network of retail service centers, operating and franchising those quick lube shops.
Valvoline Instant Oil Change, VIOC, as they call it.
So two very different business models, kind of awkwardly coexisting. It's almost like they were trying to be two companies at once.
And that dual identity, I mean, sure, it offered some diversification, maybe, but it also brought real complexities and, frankly, inefficiencies.
How so?
Well, that global product segment, the manufacturing side, it was just a beast in terms of capital investment. Think about it. Massive factories, complex global supply chains, and huge exposure to commodity price swings. You know, the cost of base oils going up and down.
Volatile.
Very. And on top of that, they were competing head-to-head with global oil giants, Shell, ExxonMobil, BP, companies that could often leverage their massive integrated energy operations. It was a tough fight.
Okay, so that's the manufacturing side. What about the retail side?
The retail services side, the VIOC centers, while it was growing, it felt almost overshadowed by the bigger manufacturing arm. It had a fundamentally different profile, though.
Right. You had this large, sort of slow-moving, capital-hungry manufacturing business next to this faster, more consumer-facing retail side.
Precisely. And then came the moment that changed everything, the defining moment, March 2023. Valvoline announces this move that, well, it really surprised some people.
Yeah, the big sale.
They sold that entire global products business, everything, to Aramco Overseas Company BV, which is a part of Saudi Aramco, and the price tag, a staggering $2.65 billion in cash.
Wow. That wasn't just tidying up the books, was it?
Yeah.
It felt more like a strategic amputation. But maybe in a good way.
It was way more than just a sale. It was a deliberate, fundamental reshaping of the company's entire DNA. The strategy behind it was actually crystal clear.
Which was?
It was all about unlocking value by completely separating these two very distinct, often conflicting business models. See, the retail services business, VIOC, it's totally different from global products. It has significantly higher margins, generally. It's directly consumer-facing, which helps build loyalty. And it has a much more predictable, scalable, and this is key capital light growth profile.
Capital light because of the franchising.
Exactly. Especially because of the strong franchise component. So this move was about shedding away the heavy capital demands of that manufacturing past to really sprint into a service-focused future.
Okay, so you get $2.65 billion landing in your bank account. That's a nice problem to have. How do you decide where to put that kind of money? What was the game plan?
Well, with that kind of capital, Valvoline had this golden opportunity to completely reshape its financial future, and they were pretty meticulous about it. The money went into three main strategic buckets.
Okay, what were they?
First, a big chunk went towards paying down debt. dramatically reducing their leverage, strengthening the balance sheet, just good at financial housekeeping, really.
Makes sense. De-risk the company.
Absolutely. Second, they doubled down on growth investments directly into that core retail network, the VIOC centers. So more money for building new company-owned stores, more money for acquiring existing quick lubes, accelerating the expansion.
Putting fuel on the fire of the remaining business.
Exactly. And third, they committed to returning a substantial amount of that cash directly to shareholders, primarily through share buybacks.
Ah, okay. So debt reduction, faster growth, and shareholder returns.
It was essentially a strategic recapitalization. It fundamentally reset their financial foundation and allowed them to have this laser focus on just one thing, the retail service business.
So after this massive divestiture, this shedding of their old skin, what is Valvoline now? What's its new identity in the market? If you're an investor, what are you actually buying?
Valvoline is now, unequivocally, a pure play automotive service retailer. Full stop. That's their identity.
Okay. Pure play.
And this move has dramatically simplified things. Their financial reporting is cleaner. It's much easier for investors, for the market, for you to understand precisely what they do and where their value comes from.
No more confusion between manufacturing and retail.
None. Their entire future, their success or failure, is now exclusively tied to the performance and, importantly, the aggressive expansion of their network of automotive service centers, VIOC. It's all about those quick lube centers and the range of services they provide directly to you, the consumer. That clarity, that's a competitive advantage in itself.
Okay, so Valvoline is now this pure play automotive service retailer. What does that actually look like day to day? And crucially, where is the money coming from? You mentioned there's just one segment now, which must really sharpen their focus.
It absolutely does. Post-sale, Valvoline operates solely as one single reportable segment, retail services. That simplification helps everyone, analysts, investors, you, understand their business much better. And when we look at their fiscal year 2024 results, we see a really clear picture of where the revenue flows from. It shows their singular focus.
Let's break that down then, because the numbers really tell the story. Their main thing still is oil changes, right? That's the core offering. What gets people in the door?
Absolutely. Oil changes and related fees are still the bedrock. In FY 2024, that accounted for about 73.4% of their total revenue. So roughly three quarters. That's about $1.19 billion.
Wow. Still a huge number.
It is. This service is fundamental. It drives the customer traffic into their bays. It's the foundation transaction they build everything else on. It's the main reason a customer chooses Valvoline over, say, going to the dealership or their local mechanic.
But they're definitely not just about oil changes anymore, are they? I keep hearing them talk about non-oil change revenue, or NOCR. They seem really focused on growing that piece to boost profits.
You're hitting on a really key strategic priority for them. NOCR is crucial, especially as, you know, oil change intervals get longer. In FY 2024, this category brought in a significant 21.6% of revenue, about $350 million.
Okay, so over a fifth of the business already. What kind of services are we talking about here?
These are typically higher margin services that they can add on to that initial visit. So think battery checks and replacements, replacing burnt out bulbs or worn wiper blades, tire rotations, which are really important, and various fluid exchanges, like transmission fluid, power steering fluid, coolant flushes.
Stuff people need, but maybe don't think about as often as an oil change.
Exactly. And management has made it an explicit strategic goal to increase the penetration, or what they call the attachment rate, of these NOCR services. The aim is simple. Get more dollars out of each car that comes through the bay. Maximize that average ticket value. And because these services often have better margins than a basic oil change, it significantly boosts overall store-level profitability.
Makes sense. Get the customer in for the oil, then offer these other needed services. And then there's the third piece, the franchise side. That must be a pretty nice high-margin revenue stream since it's mostly just fees from their partners, right?
That's a very sharp observation. Franchise fees and other accounted for the remaining 5.0% of revenue in FY 2024, which was about $80.2 million. This stream is mostly ongoing royalty fees.
Royalties based on sales.
Yeah, typically 4% to 6% of gross sales from each franchisee. Plus, they collect advertising fees, usually around 6%, also from the franchisees, to fund national marketing.
And that's attractive because...
It's incredibly attractive because it's inherently high margin. Valvoline collects the fee, but they don't bear the direct operating costs of running that franchise store. Oh. It's also very capital light for Valvoline, and it grows directly as the franchisee's sales grow. So it provides this predictable recurring income stream. It's a beautiful part of the model.
Okay, so that's the revenue breakdown. Now, when a customer actually pulls into a Valvoline instant oil change, what's the promise? What's the core value proposition they're trying to deliver that makes them different?
Their whole market position, their operational philosophy, it's built on this really clear and, frankly, very effective mantra. Quick, easy, trusted.
Quick, easy, trusted. Catchy.
It is. And what truly sets them apart in the quick lube market, and what really speaks to what consumers want today, is their roughly 15-minute stay-in-your-car service model.
Yeah, that's the big one, isn't it? No getting out, no waiting room.
Exactly. It's designed to minimize disruption. You're busy, you pull in, they do the work while you stay in your car, maybe answer emails, and you're out in about 15 minutes for a standard oil change. That convenience factor, it's a massive differentiator. People value their time.
That stay-in-your-car thing is brilliant for convenience, definitely. But let's talk about the trusted part. In the auto service industry, let's be honest, customers can be skeptical. How do they build that trust? How do you earn loyalty beyond just being fast?
That's a critical point. The trust factor is really reinforced by Valvoline's incredible 150-year brand heritage. I mean, that kind of longevity, it speaks volumes in an industry where, you know, shops can come and go. It implies a long history of hopefully consistent quality.
People recognize the name. It feels established.
It does. And they also really prioritize a transparent service process. Technicians are trained to show you the dipstick, show you the dirty filter, point out potential issues, explain recommendations clearly. They try to demystify the process, which helps build confidence and combat that skepticism you mentioned.
Does it work? Do customers actually feel that trust?
The data suggests it does. This approach has really resonated. They consistently get high customer satisfaction ratings, averaging an impressive 4.6 out of 5 stars across their system. And they get external recognition too, accolades from places like Forbes for outstanding customer service. That's a really strong foundation of credibility they've built over literally generations.
Now, this whole operation isn't just a chain of stores that Valvoline owns itself, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned the franchise model. That seems absolutely central to everything they do operationally and for their big growth plans.
Oh, absolutely fundamental. The hybrid model, having both company-owned stores and franchise stores, is foundational to Valvoline's strategy and its ambitious growth plans. Let's look at the numbers. As of the end of fiscal year 2024, the whole Valvoline network had 2,010 stores system-wide.
Okay, over 2,000.
Yeah.
How does that split break down?
It was strategically split between 950 company-operated location stores Valvoline runs itself and 1,060 franchise locations run by independent partners. So, yeah, slightly more than half of their entire system is actually run by franchisees.
That balance must be deliberate. It lets them keep control over standards in their own stores, mm-hmm. but then they can use franchise money and local know-how to expand faster, right? What's the trade-off there?
It's a very clever balancing act. Valvoline keeps direct control over critical things like brand standards, pushing operational innovation, technician training, and rolling out their proprietary SuperPro tech system in its corporate stores. That ensures consistency and lets them test new ideas. But at the same time, it cleverly leverages the capital investment, the local market knowledge, and just the entrepreneurial hustle of its franchisees to speed up network expansion. And it does that without loading up Valvoline's own balance sheet quite so heavily. The trade-off, well, it's the degree of direct day-to-day control over every single location. But Valvoline works hard to mitigate that risk through rigorous franchisee selection, extensive training, the standardized tech platform, and really robust franchise agreements.
And the actual economics for these franchisees, how good are they? Because that's what makes people want to sign up, right? To invest their own money and time.
The unit economics, the financial model for a Valvoline instant oil change franchisee, it's really quite compelling. That's why they have such a strong pipeline of people wanting to become franchisees. The average unit volume, or AUV, basically the annual sales for a typical store for a franchise location, is around $1.57 million per year.
How does that compare to other quick lube places?
It compares very favorably. That $1.57 million significantly outperforms the industry average for similar oil change franchises, which is closer to maybe $1.03 million annually.
Big difference.
It is. And if you assume a pretty healthy 15% operating profit margin, which seems achievable in this business, a typical VIOC franchise could generate an estimated EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, of around $236,000 per year.
That sounds like a solid return for the operator.
It represents a very strong cash-on-cash return and overall return on investment. It makes it a really attractive proposition for entrepreneurs who are looking for a proven business model with strong brand backing.
Those numbers are definitely impressive. What kind of standards do they have for these franchisees? They must be looking for pretty serious, well-funded partners to protect the brand.
Oh, they absolutely maintain high standards. You don't just walk in off the street. Potential franchisees typically need to show a minimum net worth of $1 million and have at least $500,000 in liquid assets, ready cash, basically.
So they need deep pockets.
It's not just about the money itself, though. It ensures they attract a well-capitalized franchisee, partners who can fund their own multi-unit growth plans, who can build several stores, and who can also weather any potential economic bumps in the road. It reduces the risk for the whole system.
And the initial investment to actually open one.
It can vary quite a bit. It might range from around $192,000, maybe on the lower end if it's a leased facility where Valvoline owns the land and building and the franchise just runs the business. Or it could go up to over $3.4 million if the franchise buys the land and builds the store from scratch. That flexibility allows different types of investors, maybe individuals or larger investment groups, to enter the system.
So you've got strong unit economics, a powerful brand, significant capital requirements for partners. This all seems perfectly designed for rapid scalability and expansion, which clearly fits into that land grab strategy they seem to be pursuing.
That's spot on. The robust economics, combined with the huge recognition and trust in the Valvoline brand, makes the franchise offering exceptionally attractive out there. This is a key reason why the company can pursue such aggressive expansion plans, aiming for 250 net new stores every year by 2027.
And focusing more on franchise growth going forward.
Yes, there's a clear emphasis on franchise-led growth for future expansion. It allows for faster, more capital-efficient market penetration. It's absolutely how they plan to rapidly grow that physical footprint and consolidate market share with speed and agility.
But the franchise model, even though it's powerful for growth, it isn't risk-free, is it? You're basically trusting independent business owners to uphold your 150-year-old brand reputation and deliver that quick, easy, trusted promise every single time. Where could things go wrong?
That's a critical and often overlooked point. Yes, it's incredibly powerful for growth, but the franchise model does carry inherent risks. Valvoline's royalty revenue stream, and more importantly, its invaluable brand image, are partly dependent on the continued financial health and the consistent day-to-day operational execution of hundreds of independent franchisees.
And Valvoline doesn't control every little detail in those stores.
By design, they have limited direct control over the daily operational details. So any significant service failures, maybe inconsistent customer experiences creeping in, or even financial trouble hitting a major franchise group that could directly impact Valvoline's overall results, lead to customers leaving, and potentially dilute that hard-earned brand perception. It's a constant balancing act between centralized standards and decentralized execution.
Okay, so Valvoline has made this massive pivot. Their core business is clear. Heavily reliant on that franchise network. But, you know, no company exists in a bubble. Let's zoom out a bit and talk about the wider industry dynamics. What's the market structure look like, and how big is the pond they're fishing in now after selling off the global products business?
Right, so Valvoline now operates squarely within the huge U.S. automotive service market. Now, even though they sold the lubricant manufacturing business, it's still useful to understand the broader auto lubricants market because, well, their service centers still have to buy the oil and filters and stuff from somewhere.
Their costs are affected by it.
Exactly. Globally, lubricants is a vast, mature industry. Estimates range, but maybe $70 billion to $95 billion globally. But it's slow-growing, low single-digit CAGR, you know, maybe 1.5% to 4% a year. The U.S. piece of that is still significant, maybe $25 billion. So while Valvoline isn't making the oil anymore, the price and supply of lubricants definitely still influence the costs at their service centers.
But their direct market, the place they actually compete day to day, is really the U.S. oil change service market. And that sounds like it might be growing faster.
It absolutely is. And this is their true focus now. The U.S. oil change service market is smaller, yes, but significantly faster growing. It was valued around $8.1 billion in 2024. But projections show a much healthier growth rate, a CAGR of maybe 5.9%, expected to reach something like $11.3 billion by 2030.
So the service side is growing faster than the product side. Why is that?
This faster growth in the service part really highlights a major consumer trend, the shift towards do-it-for-me or DIMM solutions. Fewer people are changing their own oil these days.
Yeah, I definitely don't.
Right. People are busy. Cars are getting more complex. Maybe they just prefer the convenience of having a professional handle it. That shift directly benefits companies like Valvoline that offer these convenient DIMM services.
And within this quick lube service market, what's the competitive landscape like? Is it still mostly small, independent mom-and-pop garages, or are bigger players taking over?
It's definitely consolidating, and pretty rapidly. The U.S. quick lube market is really transforming from that highly fragmented state, lots of single-location operators, to one that's increasingly dominated by a few large, well-capitalized national brands. It's not just organic growth driving this, it's aggressive acquisitions of those smaller independent shops.
So who are the main players Valvoline is really bumping heads with? Who keeps them on their toes?
Well, the primary competitors are names you'll likely recognize. Jiffy Lube International, that's owned by Shell, has historically been the biggest by store count. Over 1,900 locations, and interestingly, they are all franchised.
Okay, so Jiffy Lube is hashtag one in stores.
Historically, yes. Then you have Valvoline Instant Oil Change itself with, as we said, 2,010 system-wide stores at the end of FY 2024. That puts them firmly as the second largest player, and many see them as a leading consolidator in the space, growing both organically and through buying other chains.
But there's another name that seems to be growing incredibly fast, Take 5.
Ah, Take 5 Oil Change. Yes, they are the ones to watch. They're a subsidiary of a company called Driven Brands. Take 5 is the third largest, but they are arguably the most aggressive grower right now.
How aggressive?
Since Driven Brands bought them back in 2016, Take 5 has exploded. They went from just 65 locations then to an incredible 11,181 by the end of 2024. Their model also emphasizes speed and efficiency, and that rapid expansion makes them a really formidable competitor.
Wow, that's huge growth. Anyone else significant?
Beyond those big three national players, you also have this next tier of brands, often backed by private equity money, names like Grease Monkey, Strickland Brothers, Express Oil Change. They're also actively buying up smaller players and building out their regional footprints. So yeah, it's a dynamic, consolidating, and increasingly tough competitive environment where having scale and moving fast really matters more than ever.
Okay, so Valvoline is in a growing market, but it's also getting more competitive with these big players consolidating. What about the really big long-term industry trends? Are there strong tailwinds helping them sail, or are there major headwinds they need to brace for that could totally change their future?
Yeah, their long-term path is definitely being shaped by several really powerful and sometimes conflicting trends. The biggest one, the one that gets the most attention and often makes investors pause, is undoubtedly the accelerating adoption of electric vehicles, EVs.
Right. This feels like the potential killer app for an oil change company. I mean, EVs just don't use engine oil. How do you even start to deal with that kind of existential threat?
You've nailed the core challenge. Battery electric vehicles, BEVs, they simply lack an internal combustion engine, which means fundamentally no engine oil, no traditional oil changes. That directly attacks Valvoline's core service, the thing that brings in most of their customers.
Can they service EVs at all?
Well, it's true that EVs still need other types of service. And Valvoline can provide some of those things like brake fluid changes, coolant service for the battery systems, tire rotations, checking battery health. But the reality is, the frequency of those services, and usually the revenue per visit, is generally lower than for a traditional oil change.
And EVs are coming faster now, right?
The pace of adoption is definitely accelerating globally. Some projections suggest EVs could be more than one out of every four new vehicles sold worldwide as soon as 2025. This is a huge, undeniable, long-term structural challenge. It demands a really smart strategic response from Valvoline.
That's a massive headwind, no doubt about it. But are there any tailwinds? Anything pushing them forward, giving them some breathing room against that EV wave?
There is a really crucial and maybe sometimes underappreciated medium-term tailwind. The increasing age of the cars already on the road in the U.S.
Older cars. How does that help?
The average age of light vehicles driving around today has climbed to over 12 years. That's a record high. Here's why it benefits Valvoline. Older vehicles are usually out of their original manufacturer's warranty.
So owners aren't tied to the dealership anymore.
Exactly. They become much more likely to seek out more cost-effective service options from independent providers, like Valvoline Instant Oil Change. Plus, older cars simply tend to need more frequent maintenance and repair as things start to wear out. Belts, hoses, fluids, you name it. This creates a durable and actually growing base of demand for the kinds of services Valvoline offers. It provides a significant buffer against that looming EV threat, essentially extending their profitable runway for ICE vehicles.
Okay, so on one side, the existing fleet is getting older and needs more service, which is good for Valvoline. But on the other side, even for newer gasoline cars, the main service they offer, the oil change, is needed less often. That brings us to another headwind, those longer oil change intervals.
You're absolutely right. This is a more subtle but still very impactful headwind. Big improvements in lubricant technology, especially the widespread use of high-performance synthetic oils, have allowed car manufacturers to recommend much longer intervals between oil changes.
Yeah, it's not 3,000 miles anymore.
Not for most cars, no. The traditional 3,000-mile rule is largely gone, replaced by recommendations of 10,000 miles, 15,000 miles, sometimes even more, for many modern vehicles using synthetic oil.
And that directly hits Valvoline's business model.
It directly reduces the frequency of customer visits. That's a fundamental challenge for a business model built around regular service intervals. It puts even more pressure on them to retain the customers they have, and as we discussed, to maximize the value of every single visit through selling those higher margin and OCR services. You just have fewer shots on goal, so each one needs to count more.
But there's another consumer trend that's definitely a tailwind for them, isn't there? That shift you mentioned from do-it-yourself to do-it-for-me, that seems like a perfect fit for their business.
It is indeed a powerful, well-established, and ongoing trend. People are moving away from DIY car maintenance towards professional do-it-for-me or DIM services, and there are several reasons for this.
Like what?
Well, cars are just getting incredibly complex. Electronic systems everywhere. It makes DIY harder and maybe riskier if you mess something up. People are also more time-crunched than ever, less leisure time for crawling under the car. And frankly, many people just prefer the convenience and perceived reliability of having a professional service provider like Valvoline handle it. This trend directly and powerfully benefits Valvoline's whole setup. Streamlined, convenient, trusted. It drives more customers through their doors who might have previously done the work themselves.
Okay, so pulling these trends together, how does this all shake out in terms of the business cycle? Is automotive maintenance an industry that gets hammered in recessions, or is it more defensive, maybe even recession-proof?
Yeah, that's a good question. The auto maintenance industry is generally considered pretty defensive. It's less susceptible to big economic swings than many other consumer sectors. Why? Because basic vehicle maintenance is largely non-discretionary. You need your car to get to work, to school, right? It needs to be safe and reliable.
You can't just stop changing the oil indefinitely.
Exactly. And think about this. During economic downturns, people often delay buying new cars. What does that mean? They keep their existing cars longer, which paradoxically tends to increase the average age of the cars on the road and thus increases the overall need for maintenance and repair services.
So a recession might actually help their business in some ways.
It can provide a counter-cyclical boost to the maintenance side. Valvoline's own recent performance through periods of economic uncertainty has shown strong resilience. Management has said they haven't seen significant evidence of customers deferring essential services. People just keep maintaining their cars, maybe even more carefully when they know they have to make them last longer.
That resilience is definitely key. But let's circle back to that long-term EV question. It still feels like this huge looming cloud, maybe an existential threat, even if it's happening slowly. How does Valvoline think about that from a really long-term perspective?
This is where the nuance is just critical, and it's really the core analytical question for anyone trying to value Valvoline or understand its long-term investment case. Yes, the long-term threat of EV adoption is often seen as the biggest risk, and it is a huge risk. However, but that perspective sometimes underestimates the sheer durability of demand from the existing fleet of internal combustion engine ICE vehicles. The crucial factor isn't just the flow of new EVs hitting the road each year, it's the incredibly slow turnover of the stock of vehicles already out there. We're talking about nearly 280 million ICE vehicles currently on U.S. roads.
Wow, that's a massive number.
It is. And with the average age over 12 years and cars typically lasting 15 to 20 years, maybe even longer now, That existing ICE fleet creates this long, predictable tail of demand for traditional oil changes and related services. It will likely persist well into the 2030s and maybe even beyond for some vehicle segments. It's not like flipping a switch. It's a very long, very gradual slope downwards for ICE vehicle service needs.
Okay, so it's not a sudden cliff edge they're driving towards. It's more like a very, very long, gentle decline for their core business. And Valvoline can actually use that extended period to their advantage strategically.
Precisely. This extended time frame gives Valvoline what you could call a multi-decade harvesting period.
Harvesting?
Yeah, a period where they can continue to generate really robust cash flows from their established IC-focused services. And during this time, they can use that cash to fund critical strategic priorities.
Like what? What's the to-do list during this harvesting period?
Priority one is using that cash to rapidly expand their physical network, consolidate market share, that land grab strategy we talked about, build or buy more stores, get the best locations. Priority two is enhancing their service capabilities, not just for the remaining ICE vehicles, but crucially, developing services for the growing number of hybrids and EVs. Think tire services, brakes, battery health checks, thermal management systems for EVs. They need to be ready.
Get ahead of the curve on EV service.
Exactly. And priority three, all that cash flow allows them to return substantial capital to shareholders along the way through those buybacks we mentioned. So the central analytical question really becomes, does the present value of all those future cash flows, even knowing they will eventually decline, justify the company's current valuation? It's a complex balancing act between today's strength and preparing for tomorrow's inevitable evolution.
We've covered the big picture, the industry, the business model.
Yeah.
Now let's drill down into what really makes Valvoline stand out from the competition. What gives them a competitive edge, a moat around their business that's hard for others to copy?
Valvoline has definitely built a remarkably durable competitive position over the years. One of the absolute strongest pillars of that moat is just its incredible brand equity.
The Valvoline name itself?
Yeah. With a heritage stretching back over 150 years, the Valvoline brand is one of the most recognized and, importantly, trusted names in the entire automotive industry. For many consumers, it's almost synonymous with reliable car care.
That's huge, especially in an industry like auto service where trust and reliability are just paramount. People can be really wary about where they take their cars.
It is, absolutely. That long history has built up this deep reservoir of consumer trust. That's a critical asset, especially when customers might feel uncertain about service recommendations or the quality of the work being done elsewhere. This powerful brand recognition also effectively lowers their customer acquisition costs.
How so?
Well, people already know the name. They already have some level of trust, so Valvoline doesn't have to spend as much just getting people in the door compared to a newer, less known brand. And that trust also helps support more premium pricing for their services.
And they get awards too, right?
Yeah, the brand's strength is constantly reinforced through their national marketing, but also by external validation, like being ranked hashtag #1 by Entrepreneurs Franchise 500 in their category, or getting recognized by Forbes for excellent customer service. That's tangible proof of brand strength that's just really hard for a competitor to build overnight.
Okay, so brand is huge.
Yeah.
Beyond that, they also have that massive distribution network. That scale, with over 2,000 locations now, that must create its own advantages that smaller chains just can't match.
It creates a massive advantage. Valvoline operates the second largest quick lube network in the U.S. That extensive physical footprint creates what you could call a significant convenience moat.
A convenience moat?
Yeah, think about it. Customers are much more likely to choose a trusted brand that also happens to have a location conveniently near their home or their workplace. Being everywhere matters. And that scale also leads to big operational advantages, like procurement power.
Buying supplies cheaper.
Exactly. They can negotiate much better pricing with suppliers for all the ancillary products they sell, filters, wipers, batteries, fluids. That directly helps their own profitability and the margins of their franchisees. They buy in bulk for the whole system.
And their sheer size must help with marketing too, right? Mm. It's got to be way more efficient to advertise nationally for 2,000 stores than for, say, a regional chain with 50.
Precisely. They have the scale to run sophisticated national advertising campaigns that benefit the entire system, companies, stores, and franchisees alike. Smaller regional players just can't afford that kind of reach. Plus, Think about the data.
Data.
With such a huge volume of transactions happening every day across thousands of stores, they can leverage sophisticated data analytics. They can see trends, optimize pricing strategies store by store, refine their service offerings based on real-time demand, and target their marketing campaigns much more effectively than smaller competitors who just don't have that wealth of data.
You mentioned their operational excellence earlier, highlighted by that incredible 18-year streak of same-store sales growth. How do they maintain that kind of consistency across 2,000 locations, a mix of company-owned and franchised? Is there some kind of, like, proprietary secret sauce that keeps everything running so smoothly?
Yeah, their consistent delivery, 18 consecutive years of positive system-wide same-store sales growth, that is the ultimate proof of their superior operational execution. It's truly remarkable in retail. A key piece of how they achieve that consistency is Valvoline's proprietary Super Pro management system.
Super Pro, okay, what is that exactly?
It's not just a basic cash register or point of sale system, it's much more. It's an integrated workflow management technology that the technicians use right in the service bay on tablets.
So it's more than just ringing up the sale, it actually guides the work itself, almost like a digital checklist or assistant for the techs.
That's a great way to put it. It standardizes the entire service process, ensuring quality control step by step, from bay to bay, store to store, regardless of whether it's a company location or a franchise. It provides data-driven service recommendations based on the specific vehicle's history, its mileage, and importantly, the original equipment manufacturer's OEM recommended maintenance schedule.
So it tells the tech what the car manufacturer recommends.
Exactly. It helps ensure they're recommending the right services at the right time based on the car's needs, not just guesswork. This proprietary system is really the technological backbone that allows Valvoline to reliably deliver on that quick, easy, trusted promise at scale. Doing that consistently across such a large, spread-out network is incredibly difficult. Super Pro helps reduce variability and ensures a more consistent customer experience everywhere.
And what about keeping customers and franchisees loyal? Are there switching costs involved? Is it hard for people to leave once they're in the Valvoline ecosystem?
That's another layer of the moat. For consumers, the direct monetary cost of switching to a competitor might seem low, right? You just drive to a different quick loop next time. However, Valvoline builds significant soft switching costs through that consistently positive customer experience.
Soft switching costs? Like what?
The trust built by the brand, combined with the sheer speed and convenience of the service model. It creates strong customer loyalty and encourages repeat business. People value their time, they value a hassle-free experience, they value not feeling ripped off. Once you find a place that delivers that consistently, you tend to stick with it.
Okay, so loyalty through good service. What about the franchisees? Are they locked in?
Oh, for franchisees, the switching costs are exceptionally high. Very sticky. These partners make significant upfront capital investments, sometimes millions of dollars, in their locations, often in specialized buildings designed for the VIOC model. And they're bound by long-term agreements. The franchise agreement itself, royalty payment commitments, supply agreements for Valvoline products. It's a major long-term commitment.
So they can't just easily switch to being a Jiffy Lube or a Take 5 franchisee?
Not easily at all. It would involve huge financial penalties and logistical hurdles. This creates a highly stable and predictable recurring revenue stream for Valvoline from those franchise fees and ensures the long-term integrity and stability of the whole network. It's a deep commitment on both sides, locking the system together.
So it really sounds like it's not just one of these advantages working alone, but how they all interconnect and reinforce each other that creates the real strength, that moat.
Yeah.
Like a virtuous cycle that's hard for competitors to break into. Can you just walk us through how that cycle works?
Exactly. The durability of Valvoline's competitive advantage isn't from any single thing, but from the way its powerful brand, its standardized efficient service model, and its extensive network density all work together. It creates this powerful, self-reinforcing, virtuous cycle.
Okay, how does it start?
It starts with the trusted brand. That initially attracts customers because they recognize the name, they associate it with reliability. Then, the consistent, efficient, and transparent service experience standardized by that Super Pro technology builds real loyalty and drives the repeat business.
What it leads to?
Which leads to strong same-store sales growth. Those happy customers keep coming back and maybe spending a bit more each time. The resulting superior store-level profitability then makes the VIOC franchise model incredibly attractive to potential new operators. They see existing franchisees succeeding.
So good performance attracts more franchisees.
Exactly. And that fuels the network expansion. More franchisees wanting to open stores means the network grows faster. As the network grows, its density increases, more Valvoline locations popping up. That further enhances that convenience moat we talked about. There's always a Valvoline nearby.
And more stores mean more visibility.
Right. It boosts brand visibility even more, which ultimately draws even more new customers into the system. And the cycle starts again. Brand attracts customers. Service builds loyalty. Loyalty drives profits. Profits attract franchisees. Franchisees build stores, more stores, increase convenience and visibility, which attracts more customers. It's this integrated system that's exceedingly difficult for smaller, less capitalized competitors or maybe less disciplined franchisers to replicate. That's the core of Valvoline's economic moat. It's a compounding competitive advantage that actually gets stronger as the system grows.
Okay, with that strong moat established, let's shift gears and look at the financials. How does all this translate into performance, especially now that Valvoline is this focused, pure-play retail services company? That sale of Global Products must have really changed their financial picture.
It fundamentally altered it, yeah, giving them a much clearer, generally higher margin profile. So our analysis here, everything we talk about financially, focuses exclusively on the results of the continuing operations, just the retail services business. That gives you, the listener, a clear, undiluted view of where the company is now and its future potential. And what really jumps out immediately is the robust, almost accelerating growth this retail-focused business has shown over the last few years. They've really been firing on all cylinders.
How robust are we talking? What kind of top-line revenue growth have they actually put up since spinning off the manufacturing side?
Revenue from these continuing operations has shown really impressive year-over-year growth. It jumped 12.2% in fiscal year 2024, reaching $1.62 billion, and that came after even stronger growth rates, 16.8% in FY 2023, and a remarkable 19.2% in FY 2022.
Wow, consistently strong double-digit growth. What's driving that?
It's a direct result of their two main growth levers working together. First, healthy same-store sales growth, meaning existing stores are performing well. And second, aggressive unit expansion, they're adding new stores to the network at a rapid clip. It's growth from both existing assets and new ones.
And speaking of same-store sales, that's often seen as the gold standard, right? The truest measure of a retailer's underlying health and whether customers are happy. What's the track record there? You mentioned it earlier.
It's almost legendary in retail, frankly. An 18-year consecutive streak of positive system-wide same-store sales growth. Think about that 18 years, through the Great Recession, through the pandemic, through intense competition. They just kept growing sales at existing locations.
That's incredible consistency. What was it recently?
In FY 2024, SSS grew by a very healthy 6.7%. And that was on top of really strong comps the previous year's 13.7% growth in FY 2022 and an amazing 21.2% in FY 2021 coming out of the pandemic disruption.
What's driving that SSS growth? More people coming in or people spending more?
It's been a healthy mix of both. Increased customer transactions, literally more cars coming through the bays, and also a higher average ticket value per visit. That higher ticket is boosted by their efforts to sell more premium oils, and crucially, by successfully selling more of those non-oil change revenue, NOCR services we talked about. So existing stores are performing exceptionally well, attracting more customers, and getting more revenue from each one.
And they're not just relying on existing stores, they're also adding those new physical locations really quickly. That seems critical for that land grab strategy.
That's right. The physical expansion is a key part of their growth engine and their plan to consolidate the market. The company has been aggressively expanding its store footprint, adding a net 158 stores to the system in FY 2024 alone. This rapid new store growth, combined with the strength in their existing stores, paints a very compelling picture of their overall top-line momentum.
What about the bottom line? Has this impressive revenue growth translated into better profitability, especially now that they have this more capital-light, service-focused model?
Absolutely. Valvoline has shown a clear ability to expand its profit margins alongside that revenue growth. In FY 2024, their adjusted EBITDA, that's a common measure of operating profitability from continuing operations, grew a significant 17% year over year, reaching $443 million. And importantly, their adjusted EBITDA margin improved by a full percentage point, or 100 basis points, to 27.3%.
So they're keeping more of each sales dollar as profit.
Exactly. Now, like many businesses, they have faced some pressure on their gross profit margins from inflation and product costs and labor wages. But overall margins remain very healthy. And strategically, that continued shift towards a more franchise-heavy model over time is expected to help margins even more at the corporate level.
Why is that?
Because those royalty streams they get from franchisees, that 4-6% of sales, they carry very high margins for Valvoline itself because Valvoline doesn't have the direct costs of running the store, the rent, the labor, the utilities for that specific franchise location. So more franchise revenue generally means higher overall corporate margins.
And all of this strong growth and profitability points towards a company that generates a lot of cash, right?
Yeah.
Cash is king, especially if you want to fund aggressive growth and return capital to shareholders.
Indeed, the business model is a very strong cash flow generator. In fiscal 2024, these continuing operations produced $283 million in cash flow from operating activities. And even after spending significantly on building new stores, they still generated $59 million in free cash flow.
The free cash flow is what they can use for buybacks, debt paydown, or more growth.
Precisely. And another metric, return on assets, which is maybe more representative now after the big balance sheet changes from the divestiture, stood at a healthy 8.5%. That compares pretty favorably within their industry, suggesting they're using their assets efficiently to generate profits.
So selling off the global product business wasn't just about simplifying things. It really seems to have put their financial health on a much stronger footing, giving them a lot more flexibility to make moves.
It significantly strengthened their financial position, no doubt about it. And it provided immense financial flexibility. Management was smart. They used a good chunk of that roughly $2.25 billion in net cash proceeds from the sale to dramatically pay down debt. As of March 2025, their total debt stood at a much more manageable $1.1 billion.
And how does that debt level compare to their earnings?
The company is targeting a net leverage ratio, that's net debt divided by adjusted EBITDA, in the range of 2.5 to 3.5 times. That's generally considered a very prudent and healthy level for a business like this, one with such a significant, stable stream of franchise royalties and recurring service revenue. It gives them plenty of breathing room.
And what about their liquidity for future moves? Do they have enough cash sitting around to fund that aggressive expansion strategy, or are they running lean?
They appear to have ample liquidity. As of the end of the second quarter of fiscal 2025, they had $62 million in cash and cash equivalents on hand. Plus, they have access to undrawn credit facilities, like a corporate credit card. That combination provides more than enough financial flexibility to fund their ongoing, ambitious capital expenditure program for building new stores and to pursue opportunistic acquisitions as part of their growth strategy, all without putting undue stress on the company. They're not just growing, they're doing it from a really solid financial base.
This definitely sounds like a company with a very clear, very aggressive growth strategy mapped out, almost like a blueprint for expansion. What are their main priorities for putting that capital to work?
Yeah, Valvoline's management has laid out a crystal clear and highly focused growth strategy. It centers on three interconnected priorities. First, basically get the most out of the stores they already have, drive the full potential of the existing business by maximizing profitability per store. Second, accelerate the network growth, especially using that franchise model. And third, strategically expand their service offerings so they can handle the cars of the future, not just today's cars.
Let's start with that network expansion. They're aiming for a lot more stores, right? This seems like the absolute core of their land grab strategy.
This is indeed the primary engine of their growth and the most visible part of that land grab. Management has set an incredibly ambitious long-term goal. Expand the network from its current base of just over 2,000 stores to a staggering 3,500 stores across the U.S. and Canada.
Wow, 3,500, that's another 1,500 stores, roughly.
Yeah.
Huge increase.
It's massive growth, over 60% increase from where they are now. In the nearer term, the company is actively working to ramp up its pace of development. The target is to be adding 250 net new units per year by the year 2027. For this current fiscal year, 2025, they've guided for a more conservative but still very strong 160 to 185 net new store additions. They're steadily ramping up towards that 250 annual target. It's all about rapidly increasing their physical presence, making it even more convenient for customers to find a Valvoline.
How are they actually doing this rapid expansion? Is it all just building brand new locations from the ground up, or is there a more varied approach to hitting that 3,500 store target?
It's a very shrewd, multifaceted approach, not just building new stores, although that's a big part of it. Yes, there's organic growth, building new VIOC locations from scratch. That includes both stores, Valvoline builds and owns itself, and new stores developed by their franchisees.
Okay, so new builds. What else?
A huge lever for them is strategic acquisitions. They're actively buying up independent quick lube operators and smaller regional chains, and then converting them over to the Valvoline system and brand. That pending acquisition of Breeze Auto Care, which would add nearly 200 stores in one go, that's a prime example of this M&A-driven growth strategy. It lets them gain significant market share really quickly.
Okay, new builds, acquisitions, anything else?
Yes. The third piece is something called refranchising. This is where Valvoline strategically sells some of its mature, established, company-operated stores to well-capitalized franchise partners.
Why would they sell stores they already own?
It allows Valvoline to essentially recycle capital. They sell an established, cash-generating asset, and then they can take that cash and reinvest it into building new stores in potentially higher growth areas. It also helps them transition towards an even more capital-light business model over time with a higher percentage of franchise stores. It's a very efficient capital recycling machine, turning existing assets into fuel for new growth.
Very clever. Okay, so besides just adding more stores, they're also focused on getting more money out of each customer visit. That connects back to that NOCR, the non-oil change revenue we talked about earlier. How hard are they pushing that?
Exactly. A parallel and equally critical focus is driving that same store sales growth by significantly increasing the value extracted from each customer visit. A core part of this is aggressively increasing the attachment rate of those higher margin NOCR services.
Remind us what those are again.
Things like battery tests and replacements, new wiper blades, coolant flushes, transmission fluid changes, tire rotations. By leveraging the customer traffic that comes in for the basic oil change, Valvoline aims to sell these additional, more profitable services, thereby boosting the average ticket price per car.
And they're also looking at fleets.
Yes, they're strategically targeting the commercial fleet segment, delivery vans, service trucks, that sort of thing. They recognize that fleet customers offer consistent, recurring, high-volume business. Fleets really value the speed, efficiency, and reliability that Valvoline's model provides for keeping their vehicles on the road and minimizing downtime.
Makes sense. And geographically, where is the focus? And how are they preparing for the future mix of cars on the road? Are they looking overseas, or is it all North America for now?
The immediate growth priority is definitely domestic, focused on building out that footprint in underserved markets across the U.S. and Canada to get towards that 3,500 store target. International expansion of the retail service model, it's explicitly not a stated near-term priority. Their non-U.S. operations are tiny right now, less than 3% of total revenue.
Okay, so focus on North America. What about preparing for EVs and hybrids?
Critically, management has been very clear about their intent to innovate continuously to meet the needs of this evolving vehicle fleet. This includes actively developing service capabilities specifically for hybrid and electric vehicles. They're focusing on emerging service needs like battery health diagnostics, servicing the high-voltage coolant systems in EVs, and specialized tire and brake maintenance required by heavier electric cars. They know they need to remain relevant as the automotive landscape shifts, so they are building a more diversified service portfolio for the future.
It really sounds like they're in a full-on land grab phase right now, trying to consolidate the quick lube market as fast as they possibly can, maybe because they see that the clock is ticking on the peak profitability of the traditional oil change business.
That's precisely the most accurate way to frame it, I think. Valvoline is moving aggressively to consolidate the still fragmented quick lube market. They likely recognize there's a finite window, maybe a decade, maybe two, of peak profitability for the traditional oil change model before the EV transition really starts to bite significantly.
So grab market share now while the grabbing is good.
Exactly. By rapidly expanding their network now, securing the best real estate locations, they aim to establish an insurmountable network advantage, basically being the most convenient, trusted option everywhere someone might need a quick vehicle service. This huge, conveniently located footprint will then serve as a critical asset as the vehicle fleet inevitably transitions over the coming decades.
So.
The goal is to own the customer relationship and the physical service points. If they own the convenient locations and the customer trust, they believe they can then pivot their service offerings over time, shift the emphasis away from traditional oil changes towards the broader maintenance needs of hybrids and EVs, tires, brakes, batteries, fluids, inspections. That way, they ensure long-term relevance and continued cash flow generation, even as the engine under the hood changes. It's a strategic race to establish dominance before the landscape changes irrevocably.
Okay, so we've seen Valvoline's aggressive growth strategy. How does that translate into their capital allocation? Where are they actually putting their money, And how are they balancing that drive for growth with returning cash to shareholders?
Yeah, the capital allocation picture became much clearer and, frankly, stronger after they sold off Global Products. The strategy now is really about balancing disciplined reinvestment, putting money back into the business to fuel that aggressive growth with returning substantial amounts of capital to shareholders. That big chunk of cash they got from the sale, roughly $2.25 billion net, gave them the firepower to do three things at once: pay down debt, accelerate those growth investments we just talked about, and significantly ramp up shareholder returns. It's a well-defined three-part approach.
And it seems like share repurchases, buying back their own stock, are the main way they're returning capital, right? They seem to be prioritizing that.
That's absolutely correct. Share buybacks have become the primary method. They're generally seen as more tax efficient for shareholders than dividends, and they offer the company more flexibility. In fiscal 2024, Valvoline returned a pretty substantial $227 million to shareholders through these buybacks.
Do they have authorization to do more?
Yes. At the end of FY 2024, they still had a significant $385 million remaining under their board's share repurchase authorization. So, plenty of capacity for future buybacks. However, for fiscal 2025, management has guided for a more moderate pace, somewhere between $40 million and $70 million in repurchases.
Why the slowdown in buybacks this year?
It reflects their increased allocation of capital towards building those new stores, supporting that critical land grab strategy we just discussed. Right now, they seem to be prioritizing investing in future growth slightly ahead of massive buybacks, though they're still returning a decent amount.
So they're clearly prioritizing reinvesting in the business over, say, rapidly increasing their dividend payment.
Exactly. While the company does pay a dividend and has a history of doing so, the strategic emphasis has clearly shifted towards repurchases and reinvestment. The dividend policy is likely to remain pretty conservative, maybe growing slowly, with the bulk of excess cash flow going towards those buybacks and, more importantly right now, funding those ambitious growth initiatives. Management seems to view buybacks and Yes, M&A remains a key component of the growth strategy and a significant potential use of capital. That pending acquisition of Breeze Auto Care shows they're willing to do large network expanding deals. And they, along with their franchisees, also continue to scoop up smaller independent operators in what they call tuck-in acquisitions. It's really a full court press on network expansion using all available levers.
This whole ambitious plan, the pivot, the aggressive growth, the capital deployment, it all hinges on having strong leadership and really impeccable execution. After such a massive corporate makeover, what can you tell us about the quality of Valvoline's management team? Do they seem like the right people to steer the ship through this?
That's a crucial question. And yes, Valvoline is indeed led by an experienced executive team that seems particularly well-suited for this next phase. They have deep expertise in retail operations, corporate strategy, and finance, all critical for guiding a pure-play service provider. The CEO is Lori Flees. She was appointed in October 2023, and she brings a really strong background in retail ops and strategy.
Where did she come from?
She spent nearly a decade in senior leadership roles at Walmart, including being COO of their health and wellness division. Before that, she was a partner at Bain & Company for 17 years. That kind of experience optimizing large-scale retail operations, focusing on efficiency and customer experience, is directly applicable to scaling Valvoline's high-volume, service-centric model.
Okay, strong retail background at the top. What about the financial side? The CFO?
Their CFO is Kevin Willis, appointed in May 2025. He brings a massive amount of experience and critically deep institutional knowledge of Valvoline. He spent an incredible 37 years at Ashland Inc., which was Valvoline's former parent company, and he served as CFO there too.
Wow, 37 years. He must know the company inside out.
Exactly. His deep understanding of Valvoline's financial history, its operational nuts and bolts, its structure that provides crucial stability and continuity during this huge strategic transformation. He's a steady hand on the financial tiller.
And their track record of execution, especially that 18-year streak of positive same-store sales growth we keep coming back to, that's pretty remarkable in the retail world. It really speaks volumes about their operational discipline, doesn't it?
It is truly remarkable. The management team and the whole organization really have an exceptional track record. That 18-year run of positive SSS growth is compelling evidence of superior operational discipline, their ability to adapt to changing markets, and just a knack for delivering consistently strong results through thick and thin recessions, competition, even the pandemic. You don't achieve that by accident.
And they pulled off that huge divestiture successfully, too.
Yes. The successful separation and sale of the global products business, which unlocked so much value, also demonstrates management's strategic vision and their proven ability to execute incredibly complex corporate deals that fundamentally reshape the company. They seem to know what they're doing.
And how open are they with investors? Do they provide enough information for people like you and our listeners to really dig in and understand what's going on under the hood?
Valvoline generally maintains a high standard of communication and transparency with the investment community. They provide detailed quarterly earnings releases, comprehensive investor presentations that you can find online, and they hold accessible conference calls where analysts can ask tough questions. They offer clear guidance on key performance metrics.
Do they use adjusted numbers?
Yes. Management extensively uses non-GAAP measures like adjusted EBITDA and adjusted EPS, along with those key business metrics like system-wide store sales. They do this to provide what they argue is a clearer picture of the underlying business performance, especially given the big changes after the divestiture. But importantly, they consistently reconcile these adjusted figures back to their official GAAP equivalents in their public filings and presentations. So the transparency is there, allowing for accountability.
What about insider ownership? Do the executives have a lot of skin in the game, or is their alignment with shareholders mainly through compensation?
As of late 2024, the aggregate ownership of Valvoline stock by all the current directors and executive officers as a group was actually less than 1% of the total shares outstanding.
Less than 1%. That seems low.
It might seem low on the surface, but it's important to look at their compensation structures. They are heavily tied to equity. A significant portion of executive and director pay comes in the form of stock grants and stock options. This ensures strong alignment with shareholder interests because their personal wealth is directly impacted by how well the company stock performs over the long term.
Okay, now for the really tricky part. Valuation. Trying to put a fair price tag on all of this. Valuing Valvoline must be incredibly nuanced, right? You have to factor in the successful transformation they've already done, but also weigh those undeniable long-term risks looming on the horizon.
It absolutely requires a highly nuanced approach, maybe more so than for many other companies right now. You have to give them credit for successfully becoming this pure play, higher margin, franchise-driven service retailer. But you simultaneously have to account for those significant long-term secular risks, especially the EV transition. And finding direct peer companies to compare them to is actually quite challenging because of their unique mix.
So you wouldn't just compare them to, say, ExxonMobil anymore,
right?
Or even just a standard auto parts store like AutoZone.
Right.
Who are the most appropriate comparables?
Definitely not an oil company like Exxon. That ship has sailed. It's a relic of their past. The best peers are no longer those integrated oil giants. Instead, you should look at other automotive retail and service companies, and maybe also high-quality franchisers in other sectors to understand the value of that model. So relevant peers might include publicly traded auto dealership groups like Asbury Automotive or Group One Automotive, even though their model is different, or maybe even auto parts retailers that also have service operations like Advance Auto Parts or O'Reilly to some extent, though their focus is different. But yeah, integrated oil and gas producers, totally irrelevant now. It's a completely different business.
Okay, so comparing them to those more relevant, though maybe imperfect, peers.
Yeah.
How do Valvoline's valuation multiples look? Are they trading at a premium, a discount?
Valvoline's forward price-to-earnings PE ratio has been sitting around 23.5 times recently. That's noticeably higher than traditional auto retailers like Asbury, which trades closer to 8 or 9 times forward earnings, or Group One, maybe around 10 times.
So a significant premium. Is that justified?
Well, the argument for the premium is that Valvoline deserves it because of its higher margin, more capital-light franchise model, which is generally less cyclical than car sales, and because of its more consistent, historically robust growth profile. You have to assess its multiples relative to its superior growth prospects and potentially higher returns on capital compared to many traditional auto retailers who often operate on thinner margins and have much heavier asset bases like big dealership properties. So maybe the premium is warranted, maybe not entirely. That's the debate.
Okay, so relative valuation gives us some context, but it's tricky. What about trying to value them based on their future cash flows? An intrinsic valuation using a discounted cash flow, DCF analysis. That's where those long-term future assumptions must become incredibly critical, especially with the EV threat casting such a long shadow. How do you even model that?
A DCF is absolutely a critical tool here, but for Valvoline, it is extraordinarily sensitive to several key assumptions, particularly about what happens to the company beyond the next, say, 10 years. In the medium term, maybe the next 5 to 10 years, forecasting revenue is relatively straightforward. You typically base it on management's own explicit guidance for net new store additions. Remember, they're aiming for 160 to 250 per year, and their guidance for system-wide same-store sales growth, which they put in the 5% to 7% range.
And profits.
EBITDA margins should benefit from continued operating leverage as same-store sales grow, although that might be partly offset by investments they need to make and potential wage inflation. But that increasing mix of high-margin franchise royalty revenue should provide a nice tailwind to overall margins. So the near to medium term is somewhat predictable based on their plans.
But then you hit the long term, and specifically the terminal value, that calculation that represents all the cash flows beyond your explicit forecast period. That must be incredibly difficult, almost impossible, to model accurately, given the EV threat basically suggests an eventual decline in their core oil change business. How do analysts even approach that?
That is the most challenging and absolutely critical assumption in the entire DCF for Valvoline. Using a traditional perpetuity growth model, where you assume the company grows at a steady rate forever into the future, that might simply not be appropriate here.
Because the core business might actually shrink eventually.
Exactly. Given the long-term secular decline of the internal combustion engine vehicle fleet, an analyst has to make a very careful judgment call on that terminal growth rate. It could reasonably be modeled as 0% growth forever, or even negative growth in the terminal phase, to explicitly reflect the eventual erosion of the core oil change business.
What are the alternatives to a simple perpetuity growth rate?
You could use a multi-stage DCF model, maybe forecast strong growth for 5-10 years, then a period of slower growth or stagnation, and then maybe a final stage of gradual decline for the traditional business. Or you could use an exit multiple approach for the terminal value, but base that multiple on what a similar, more mature general maintenance provider might trade at in the future, likely a lower multiple than today reflects. It forces you to explicitly confront that uncertain future.
So because of all this uncertainty, scenario analysis becomes absolutely crucial here. You almost have to model a bull case and a bear case for how quickly EVs take over and how successfully Valvoline manages to pivot its services to remain relevant.
Absolutely essential. Given the inherent uncertainty around the timing and the ultimate impact of the EV transition, any robust valuation of Valvoline must include comprehensive scenario analysis. A bull case might assume maybe a slower EV adoption rate than some forecasts predict, combined with Valvoline being highly successful in expanding into profitable EV-specific services, allowing for a much longer profitable runway for the overall business.
And the bear case.
Conversely, a bear case would assume rapid EV adoption, maybe even faster than expected, leading to a quicker decline in demand for ICE vehicle maintenance. And perhaps Valvoline is less successful or slower in pivoting to relevant EV services. That scenario would lead to a much faster erosion of that terminal value and a significantly lower intrinsic valuation today. Sensitivity analysis on all the key variables, SSS growth, new store returns, the discount rate used is vital to understand what really drives the value and the range of potential outcomes.
Okay, beyond valuation, let's make sure we've covered the key risks comprehensively. What are the biggest potential pitfalls, the things that could derail Valvoline's ambitious plans? We can group them maybe by industry shifts, company-specific challenges, and broader economic factors.
Sounds good. Starting with industry risks, the electric vehicle adoption timeline is, without a doubt, paramount. Number one risk. A faster than anticipated adoption of EVs, exceeding current projections, represents the primary bear case scenario. It would directly erode demand for their core, high-frequency oil change service much sooner than expected. This would significantly shorten the cash-generating lifespan of their main business and put severe downward pressure on the company's terminal value.
And even for the remaining gasoline cars, we talked about those longer service intervals. That's a slower burn of a headwind, but it's real and ongoing.
Indeed. The continuous shift toward more advanced synthetic lubricants, allowing for those 10,000-plus mile intervals between oil changes, directly reduces the frequency of customer visits. This puts constant pressure on their transaction-driven growth model. It requires the company to be even more effective at keeping the customers they have coming back and, crucially, increasing that average ticket value per visit by successfully selling those NOCR services. They have to make each visit count more.
Any other industry risks? Maybe costs?
Yeah, there's always the risk of commodity price volatility, even though they don't make the oil anymore. Their company-owned stores and their franchisees still have to buy base oil, lubricants, filters, etc. Significant spikes in the price of these commodities could compress their profitability if those higher costs can't be fully passed through to consumers in the form of higher service prices, especially in a competitive market.
Okay, those are industry-level risks.
Mm-hmm.
What about risks specific to Valvoline itself? They rely so heavily on that franchise model, which seems like it comes with its own unique set of dependencies and potential problems.
The franchise model, while being that massive growth engine, definitely presents inherent risks. The company's success, its revenue stream from royalties, and its brand reputation are all intrinsically linked to the financial health and the operational discipline of hundreds of independent franchisees.
What could go wrong there?
Well, imagine if a major franchise group, maybe one owning dozens or even hundreds of stores, went bankrupt. That would be a significant disruption. Or if there was a widespread decline in service quality across a large portion of the network, damaging the brand. Or even unresolved legal disputes between Valvoline and its franchise partners. Any of those could harm the brand and disrupt that key source of high-margin royalty revenue.
And what about competition? You mentioned Take 5 growing like crazy.
Yes, intense competition is a major company-specific risk. The quick lube industry is consolidating, as we said, and becoming increasingly competitive. Aggressive growth from other well-capitalized consolidators, especially Take 5, could really intensify the fight for the best new store locations, for qualified technicians, which are hard to find, and ultimately for customers. This could potentially put pressure on the returns Valvoline gets from its new stores, maybe erode market share or make future acquisitions more expensive.
And their own aggressive M&A strategy, like that pending Breeze Auto Care deal, that carries its own execution risks too, doesn't it? Integrating acquisitions can be incredibly difficult.
It certainly does. Valvoline's growth plan relies heavily on buying other companies. There's always a risk that they might not be able to successfully integrate large acquisitions smoothly. You can run into operational disruptions, culture clashes if the acquired company operates differently, or simply fail to achieve the cost savings or revenue synergies that were expected when the deal was made.
And regulators can step in too.
Absolutely. Large transactions like Breeze are subject to rigorous regulatory scrutiny. The Federal Trade Commission, FTC, issued a second request for more information regarding the Breeze deal. That adds a layer of uncertainty, potential delays, or even the possibility the deal could be blocked or require modifications impacting their expansion plans.
Finally, what about broader financial and macroeconomic risks that could hit Valvoline, regardless of how well they execute?
Well, Valvoline does have a moderate amount of debt, around $1.1 billion, as we discussed. While their target leverage ratio seems manageable for a business with their cash flow profile, a significant and sustained rise in interest rates would increase their cost of servicing that debt. That could eat into profits and potentially constrain their financial flexibility for future growth investments or shareholder returns. Higher interest rates make everything more expensive.
And the economy itself. You said maintenance is defensive, but is it totally immune?
While automotive maintenance is largely non-discretionary, a really severe and prolonged recession could still lead to some pullback in consumer spending, particularly on non-critical services. In a deep downturn, customers might try to defer maintenance that isn't immediately essential or stretch the time between oil changes even further just to save cash. That would negatively impact transaction volumes and revenue, even for a defensive business like Valvoline. So they're not totally immune, just more resilient than many other sectors.
Okay, wow. We've covered a lot of ground. If we try to pull all of this together, all the strengths, the opportunities, the challenges, the risks, what does the core investment thesis look like for Valvoline? What are the main bull case drivers, the key reasons for optimism? And conversely, what are the main bear case concerns that should give investors pause?
Right, let's crystallize it. Starting with the bull case, the reasons for a positive outlook. First and foremost, Valvoline is arguably a best-in-class operator in a largely defensive industry. They've proven themselves to be a premier operator with a highly resilient business model. That powerful brand, the super convenient stay-in-your-car service, and just consistent operational execution have generated that phenomenal 18-year track record of positive same-store sales growth. It demonstrates their ability to perform robustly through all sorts of conditions. They just seem to execute better than most of their peers.
That 18-year streak really is the bedrock of the bull case, isn't it? It shows incredible discipline and customer loyalty. It's not just a flash in the pan.
It's anything but. It's proof of systemic excellence. Second bullet point. There's a clear and really extended growth runway ahead. The company has this well-defined strategic plan to grow its store network by over 60%, targeting 3,500 stores in North America. That provides a visible, predictable path for significant unit growth and revenue expansion for many years to come. It offers a clear, quantifiable growth story for investors.
And their capital allocation strategy also feeds into the bull case, right? By the clear focus on shareholders now that they've simplified the business.
Absolutely. Post-divestiture, management has adopted this clear capital allocation framework that prioritizes returning significant capital to shareholders, mainly through share buybacks, all funded by the strong and growing cash flow from the retail model. This disciplined approach should reward long-term shareholders. And the final key bull point, that durable demand coming from the aging vehicle fleet. The increasing average age of cars provides a strong multi-year tailwind. Older cars need more maintenance, they're out of warranty, owners look for independent service providers like Valvoline. That creates a stable, persistent demand base for their services for the foreseeable future, buffering against some of the EV transition pressures in the medium term.
Okay, so that's the optimistic view. Great operator, long growth runway, shareholder-friendly, benefiting from older cars. But no investment is risk-free. What about the bear case? What are the primary concerns, the main reasons for caution?
The biggest bear case concern, and it's a profound one, really overshadows everything else long-term. It's the terminal value risk stemming from the EV transition. The long-term structural shift to electric vehicles represents, potentially, an existential threat to Valvoline's core oil change business. The eventual obsolescence of the internal combustion engine creates massive uncertainty around the company's earnings power decades from now, and therefore its terminal value in any valuation model. It's a fundamental business model challenge they must navigate successfully.
And even before EVs fully take over, the competition is heating up significantly now, isn't it? Especially with aggressive players like Take 5.
Yes, that's the second major bear concern, intensifying competition in a rapidly consolidating market. The quick lube industry isn't fragmented anymore. Valvoline faces fierce competition from other well-capitalized consolidators, most notably that rapidly expanding Take 5. This could put pressure on finding good new store locations, hiring technicians, maybe force them to compete more on price, potentially squeezing the returns on new stores and making it harder or more expensive to gain market share or make acquisitions.
On the third key risk.
Execution risk on their own ambitious growth plans. The company's targets adding 250 stores a year, integrating huge acquisitions like Breeze Auto Care smoothly are very aggressive. There's always a risk of operational stumbles. Maybe they can't find enough good sites or construction costs run over, or the integration of acquired stores proves difficult or disruptive. Any significant misses on these growth targets could cause the market to lose confidence and lead to a negative re-rating of the stock. High expectations come with high execution risk.
So if you're watching Valvoline closely, trying to gauge how they're navigating these opportunities and risks, what are the absolute key metrics you should be monitoring quarter to quarter? What tells you if the story is playing out as hoped?
To effectively track their performance and see if the thesis is intact, you should really focus on a few key performance indicators, KPIs. First, system-wide same-store sales growth percentage. That's the primary measure of the health and pricing power of their existing stores. Remember, it was 6.7% in FY 2024, and their guidance for FY 2025 is 5.0% to 7.0%. Consistent positive growth here within or above guidance is central to the bull case.
Okay. SSS growth, what's next?
Second, net new store additions. This is the main driver of their top-line revenue growth and tracks their progress against that huge 3,500 store long-term target. They added 158 net new stores in FY 2024 with guidance of 160 to 185 for FY 2025. You want to see them hitting or exceeding these numbers consistently.
Makes sense. Profitability.
Third, adjusted EBITDA margin percentage. This is the key measure of their profitability and operational efficiency. It reflects their pricing power, how well they're managing costs, and the benefit from that increasing mix of high-margin franchise revenue. It was 27.3% in FY 2024. You want to see that holding steady or ideally expanding over time.
Anything else? Maybe related to the service mix.
Yes. Fourth, look for measurable growth in non-oil change revenue, NOCR, as a percentage of their total system-wide sales. Tracking this indicates how successful they are at expanding their service offerings beyond just the traditional oil change. Growing NOCR is crucial for increasing ticket value now and for ensuring their future relevance as cars evolve.
Got it. SSS, store growth, margins, and NOCR mix.
Mm.
And what about specific events or catalysts? What should we be watching for on the calendar in the near term? And then maybe looking further out, say, 2 to 5 years?
Okay, near term, over the next 6 to 12 months, definitely watch their quarterly earnings reports. Pay close attention to those KPIs we just discussed, SSS and net store additions versus their guidance. Also, the final resolution of that pending Breeze AutoCare acquisition will be huge. Getting clearance from the FTC and closing that deal would be a major positive catalyst for their expansion plans. Any further announcements about their refranchising strategy, selling corporate stores to franchisees, and how they plan to recycle that capital will also be key indicators of their capital efficiency.
And looking further out, what are the bigger milestones over the next few years that will tell us if this transformation is truly succeeding long term?
Longer term, say over the next 2 to 5 years, you'll want to see clear, demonstrated progress towards that aggressive goal of hitting 250 annual store additions and marching steadily towards the overall 3,500 total store target. That's the land grab playing out. You'll also want to see continued measurable growth in NOCR as a percentage of sales, proving they can successfully broaden their service mix. And critically, over this time frame, we need to see a much clearer articulation and evidence of robust execution of a comprehensive strategy to service electric vehicles. This means new EV-specific service offerings being rolled out, significant investment in technician training for EVs, and putting the specialized equipment needed into their bays. That successful pivot to EV service capability will be the ultimate test of their long-term relevance and their ability to truly thrive in a dramatically changing automotive world.
Wow, what a journey we've taken today, really digging into Valvoline. We've unpacked this remarkable transformation, shedding a 150-year legacy in manufacturing oil to fully embrace this new identity as a pure-play automotive service retailer.
Yeah, we've dissected its robust business model, those really compelling unit economics for its franchisees, and how it's strategically trying to navigate these powerful, often conflicting industry currents like the undeniable rise of EVs versus the surprising tailwind from all the older cars still on the road.
It really feels like a balancing act. On one hand, you absolutely have a best-in-class operator. That 18-year SSS growth streak is just phenomenal, proof of their operational chops. And their focus on customer convenience and trust, perfectly captured by that stay-in-your-car model, has clearly struck a chord and built deep loyalty.
But on the other hand, you have that undeniable long-term structural shift away from their core service. The internal combustion engine, the very technology that Valvoline's empire was built on for a century and a half, is slowly but surely giving way to electrification. It's a gradual decline, yes, a long runway perhaps, but it's a decline nonetheless.
This creates such a fascinating tension, doesn't it? This high-stakes gamble between maximizing the profits from traditional services during this extended harvesting period while simultaneously racing to build out new capabilities and grab market share for the future.
And that analytical question we kept coming back to, whether the present value of all those future cash flows, even knowing they'll eventually decline, truly justifies the company's current valuation that becomes the absolute crux of the matter for anyone looking at this company as an investment.
So here's where it gets really interesting for you, the listener, to think about. As the world of transportation continues this rapid, relentless evolution, what will it truly take for a legacy brand, a stalwart like Valvoline, to not just survive, but to actually thrive in a future where the internal combustion engine is no longer king?
Is their aggressive land grab strategy, buying up locations, consolidating market share now, is that enough? Can they pivot their services, retrain their workforce, and adapt their model fast enough and broadly enough? Or will the sheer momentum of technological change eventually overwhelm even the most disciplined best-in-class operator?
It's a compelling, real-time story of corporate reinvention, adaptation, and survival. Definitely one worth watching closely in the years ahead.